Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Great lineup of guests today. Alice Taff is here, along with Marsha Hotch, two professors from the University of Alaska's newly constituted, I guess it's sort of in the nascent stages, Alaska Native Language Program. We'll have Cameron Brockett, Taylor Vittick, and Christina Bruce, three of the divas. They'll come in and talk to us here for the Divas fundraiser. We'll have a preview of the upcoming Perseverance play. It's opening very shortly here, God of Carnage. And Thais Schaub will be here to profile her Juno Artist Gallery opening for First Friday. So stay tuned to Juno Afternoon on this periods of light rain and highs around 61 afternoon in Juno. National Native News follows.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes in the Pacific Northwest are concerned about environmental and treaty rights. As KWSO's Will Robbins reports, they're opposed to proposals involving coal.
With the use of coal in America in decline, mining companies have found a steady revenue stream in overseas markets. But to get the coal there requires a long journey by train and barge to export terminals along the Columbia River. That's a problem, according to environmentalists and tribes who say more studies on the impacts need to be done.
There are unknown effects of large amounts of coal going into the Columbia River, but even with just the two per day, you can walk along the tracks and see coal dust along the tracks.
Paul Lumley is the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. He says another issue is that with the anticipated increase in rail traffic would come a need for expansion, and that would encroach on access to treaty fishing sites.
Our tribal members are right next to the train tracks, too, and so when those trains go by, there is no place for them to go.
Meanwhile, officials at Burlington Northern Santa Fe point to research by federal regulators who express doubts that unburned coal could have harmful effects on the environment. So far, response at public hearings has been overwhelming, and both sides are encouraging tribal and non-tribal citizens to voice their opinions either in writing or at the few remaining public hearings. In Oregon, I'm Will Robbins reporting.
The father of a little girl in the middle of a custody dispute turned himself in to Oklahoma authorities Thursday. But as KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports, he's continuing the legal battle.
Dustin Brown surrendered to a sheriff in eastern Oklahoma Thursday, one day after Governor Mary Fallon signed a warrant allowing his extradition. He appeared before a state judge after being taken into custody. The Sequoia County Sheriff says Brown was released, but is fighting extradition to South Carolina, where he faces felony charges. An extradition hearing is set for next month. Brown, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, won custody of 3-year-old Veronica under the Indian Child Welfare Act, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that law did not apply in his case. A South Carolina judge later sided with Matt and Melanie Capobianco, who live near Charleston. Veronica currently lives with Brown's family in the Cherokee Nation in eastern Oklahoma. He's challenging the case in Oklahoma and tribal courts. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Oklahoma City.
In Canada, one of three Habitat for Humanity homes being built in Ontario is designated to an urban Native family.
So that's only one family that we're able to help. But if more families come forward from the Aboriginal community, we'll certainly do our best to help them actually become homeowners.
That's Donna Hicks, CEO of Habitat for Humanity National Capital Region. Hicks says the family will purchase the house interest-free with a long-term mortgage. She says discussions about more projects to help address housing needs of First Nations families took place Thursday with National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Sean Atleo. He went to the site and helped with construction.
We both have a vision of housing people appropriately. And we're not just talking about young families here. It's how can we also house our aging population appropriately, and what would that look like right across Canada? So I think that this is just a very preliminary first step. And the needs are going to be different from reserve to reserve, from urban Aboriginal families that live in Ottawa compared to one that might live in some small town somewhere else. So we realize that it's going to take a lot of discussion.
The Assembly of First Nations partnered with Habitat for Humanity a few years ago as a way to address housing needs for people on and off reserve. In November, the First Nation family will receive keys to the new house being built in a suburb of Ottawa. During this month in 2012, Federal Emergency Management Agency homes started to be delivered to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Nearly two dozen FEMA mobile homes were being set up for families after housing on the reservation was damaged by summer storms. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first guests are part of an exciting new program at the University of Alaska Southeast that has fairly recently come into to being, but I understand has its first graduates now with the concentration. Alice Taff is here. Dr. Taff is a research assistant professor of Alaska Native Languages at the university, and Marsha Hotch, who is an adjunct professor out there in the program, are both here to tell us about a party that's coming up next Wednesday. So why are we having a party?
Everyone is invited to this party on 9/11. The party is for to bring something good to 9/11, and that is the culmination of our long project to document in video and time-aligned bilingual text Tlingit conversations. Conversation is one of the genres of speech that is underdocumented. We have for Tlingit, for instance, a robust documentation of narrative and oratory, principally collected by Nora Marks Dauenhauer. But for most languages, conversation has been not something that people felt was important enough to document. But now, with the forced decline of many languages that descendants want to learn, they need to have examples, particularly when they live away from their fluent speakers or if there are not enough fluent speakers to go around for whatever reason. So this project has recorded 45 hours of Tlingit, and we will have at least 30 hours online on the UAS website with the video, the audio, and time-aligned, that is, subtitled Tlingit and English text that people can use for learning.
Marsha, did you have a part in recording this or in producing this?
Yes, I did. I also was videotaped along with elders, and I also translated and transcribed some of the work.
Now, we can access this website right now, is that right?
You can access the website right now at uas.alaska.edu/Tlingit-talk.
Okay. And when we're out there, then, could you briefly describe what we'll see?
When you come to the party at 5 o'clock next Wednesday, you will see an honoring of the people who worked on the project by name and what they contributed. You'll see a demonstration of the website, how to access and how to use the materials. The subtitles are not at the bottom of the video in the way that we're used to seeing them on movies. They're below the video itself, and they're phrase by phrase, Tlingit and English, and they can be replayed, each one, so a user can have as much opportunity as they want to listen to each one. They're searchable, and we'll be demonstrating that and demonstrating kind of a variety of the different speakers who are recorded. There are 62 different people who are recorded. in conversation with each other.
You said that this kind of recording of conversation and study of conversation is relatively rare in the study of languages. And is how unique is this particular resource, I'm wondering? Are other people doing this kind of thing with other native languages?
Yes, they are. But it's, I don't know of another corpus like this size.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the party, when we have honored people and demonstrated the website, we'll have a wonderful feed cooked by Heen Day, Donald Gregory, and Alaska Native Brotherhood Camp 70. So that's something that people can look forward to. And then we'll have, during that, open mic for whoever wants to talk about the project. And we'll have some computers around with assistants at them to help people poke around on the site and see what they can listen to.
Mm-hmm. How many people do you expect will make use of the website? Do you have a sense of how large the audience is for this?
Well, no.
No.
Because it's international.
Yeah.
We're going to be letting people know on websites that would be of interest to Tlingit people, to language revitalization people, language endangerment people, and linguists. So we do have analytics. We can see each month I'll get a report about how many people have accessed the site and where they are.
It's going to be a really interesting set of analytics, I should
think.
You both are teaching in the program out there. Will you use this as a classroom resource?
Yes, I most definitely would.
And so at the moment, without this website being in existence, have you taught Tlingit conversation before in your classes?
Yes.
Somewhat, yes.
Okay.
But
yes,
that's
I
what
have.
You teach.
Yes, that's pretty much what I teach because I grew up with the language, so I have that advantage in sharing more of the language, like dissecting up some of the words and then putting it back and helping them to move around better in the language.
What percentage, roughly, is it a majority of students who are Alaska Natives who are taking the courses out there, or is it, I'm curious about the makeup of the classes.
So far, the majority that I have had are Alaska Natives, but, you know, it's open to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And assume that someone completes this major, then are there opportunities for graduate study that would arise out of having completed this particular concentration?
Yes, and, well, for instance, the University of Alaska Fairbanks has master's degrees and PhD programs for Indigenous studies, for Indigenous scholars. Even anyone at UAS who took 2 years of Tlingit and wanted to put that on their resume for graduate school and had this 2 years of Tlingit instead of 2 years of a more usual European language study would stand out.
Okay. A major a part of the group that's probably going to be coming to the party are going to be Tlingit speakers, so I think we should invite them, don't you?
Absolutely.
Marcia?
Yundu ik we UAS campus dig. Ya Tlingit yuk atungi dot ye jun tu ane. Alice Taff awe ha in akwanik ya Tlingit programmi. Gunnarchish Kijin Gang aware September 11th Kijin Gang where Campus Kug
the Recreation Center on Back Loop Road.
Gunnarchish Gwalsha Yutu Tusatini Ug.
Well, Marcia, Alice, thank you so much. Gunachish to both of you. My accent is terrible, but anyway, thank you so much for coming down.
Gunachish.
Thank you for, yes, and folks, step out to the Recreation Center on the Back Loop Road at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, and come to the party. Enjoy some of the good food and find out about this new wonderful-sounding resource, our new website that accesses Tlingit Conversation.
This is Bird Note. It's early morning on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound. We're monitoring a colony of pigeon guillemots, black and white seabirds with bright red feet. How many birds are in the colony? What prey are they bringing to their offspring waiting in burrows in the cliffs? How often? Govinda Rosling, co-coordinator of the Pigeon Guillemot Research Group, is one of 60 volunteers who dedicate time during summer months to surveying birds at 25 breeding colonies. It's their ninth season.
We're looking at their populations, how many birds are coming. It's been very consistent, about 1,000 every year. So we just want to keep tabs on their population and just build a data baseline of where they are. We consider them an indicator species. So their health really echoes the overall health of the Salish Sea.
For Govinda, the guillemots symbolize a place and a way of life important to her.
Just entering the field of ornithology has been a new chapter in my life, and I really wanted to mark this permanently, I guess, with a tattoo of a pigeon guillemot, which is on my left arm. And these birds, you know, have certainly touched me deeply.
Citizen scientists provide detailed information. They help us understand how our activities affect the ebb and flow of wildlife populations. Come join us on the beach. Peek into a burrow or watch a pigeon guillemot, a better swimmer than flyer, land on the water in a kind of belly flop. See photos at birdnote.org.
You're in the middle of Juno Afternoon. It's 17 minutes and 33 seconds after 3 o'clock. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. And I am delighted. I have a studio full of beauty here in front of me. Three of the divas are here to join us. Among the folks in the studio are no less than Cameron Brockett, Taylor Vidic, and Christina Bruce. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.
I wonder, well, first of all, I think we should say that if you want to go see the divas, it might be too late. The sad thing is that we're now maintaining a waiting list. However, the way these waiting lists work, there are people who buy tickets to this thing every year and then their plans change. So if you get on the waiting list and show up in the lobby over there, there's a good chance that you'll be seated. Can't guarantee anything, but you ought to give it a try anyway.
Oh, definitely so, worth a try. You don't want to miss it.
No, you sure don't want to miss it. So I think I've heard at least, I know I've heard you sing, Cameron, and Taylor, it's hard to miss you singing. I love the little thing you said to the newspaper about the fact that you've come to enjoy singing the national anthem. You do it often enough that...
By this point it'd be pretty awful if I didn't enjoy it at least a little bit.
Yeah. So what kinds of things have you done? What other roles have you sung in?
Recently, I've been, Cameron and I are actually, we like to sing together.
Mm-hmm. We're in a band.
Yeah. And what's the band?
It's called The Evergreens. We're with one other fellow who plays guitar, and eventually we're going to be cool enough to play instruments as well. Mm-hmm. But we performed, we kind of grouped up at the Haynes Fair, and then we performed a couple open mics at the Alaskan. With my parents' accompaniment, of course, being under the age of, you know.
I'm finally 21. I can perform without my parents.
Yep. One day I'll grow up and be an adult or something.
Yeah. We recently opened for a show at the UAS Rec Center as well. So we're on our way. It's happening.
Yeah. So world fame is just around the corner.
Just around the corner.
I can almost see it.
Okay. Okay. And what kinds of things are you doing?
Well, I haven't been on stage much in the last couple of years. I was on stage
all through high school at JDHS, and then continued to be on stage through college, and then kind of have been taking a hiatus, doing a lot of background work for festivals, and so I'm just starting to get back on into performing, mm-hmm. and I'm really, really looking forward for tomorrow night for the opportunity to sing again on stage.
Which of the roles do you like best? I mean, are you a singer, or are you is this other stuff you've been doing on, you called it background work? Is that are we seeing a vocation emerge here, or what?
Well, I am pretty good at organization, mm-hmm. so it's fun to be a part of it, a part of theater, a part of the arts, and be a part of the background in that you're making it happen for those who are on stage. But I also have discovered in the last several years that I truly miss being on stage. So hopefully I'll be on the Perseverance stage sometime in the near future, mm-hmm. Will be volunteering with the Juno Douglas High School Theater Department this year to try my hand at teaching and directing, and then as well as doing things like this, like Who's Your Diva? And I've done Barney McClure's Singing in the Rain before, so things like that, getting back into the
That's
performing aspect.
That's a really incredible program. I think both of you have performed in Singing in the Rain, haven't you? No, you haven't. But
no.
You,
no.
No? You haven't? Oh.
One day.
Yeah. Well, you should. He's a friendly guy to work with. He really tunes you up well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very good things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. So what else are you doing besides singing as divas? Cameron?
Right now I am working full-time at Shoofly, but mm-hmm. But Taylor and I, during the entire month of October, are traveling to Thailand.
Wow.
So that's up next on the itinerary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How'd you pick Thailand?
How did we?
Out of a hat?
more or less. We had a friend who was traveling to Thailand, and we were like, well, you know, he's going to have been over there for a couple months, so he can kind of scope it out and tell us what's what. And I've never traveled outside of North America before, so this is my big, I'm exploring the world, here I go. Cameron is a world traveler, like, uh-huh. my beginning. So I was like, okay, it might be nice to know a little bit more than just flying right in blind. So.
And Taylor, you're going along, so she has adult supervision, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I thought that was the case.
So. I might make poor decisions without Taylor, so.
Oh, boy.
You are known for level-headedness. Anyway.
Thank you.
So what are you doing to prepare for your trip to Thailand, besides talking to this guy when he gets back?
Well, tonight is the dress rehearsal for uh-huh. Juno Lyric Opera, Who's Your Diva.
Uh-huh.
We each have a book about Thailand and or Southeast Asia, and we're going to start mapping it out
tonight. Yeah, we've been really busy with this show because it takes a lot of energy. It's worth it. But
yeah.
We're leaving in a good 3-4 weeks.
I do not have a return ticket yet.
Ooh.
Taylor, you need to take this woman aside and have a talk.
I know. I'm working on it.
Yeah, you're in charge of adult supervision on this thing. Okay. People can still, there's an aspect of this Who's Your Diva thing that puts you into blood-hot competition with one another for votes, right? And people can still click the button on the website
until noon tomorrow.
Noon tomorrow.
Vote, so, vote, vote, vote for Christina.
Vote for Taylor.
I'm just going to tell you the web address right now.
This is Taylor.
Do you want the web address?
Yes, I
certainly
do.
Okay, I'm going for it. Sorry, okay. I thought I had it. Select all. Edit. Copy. Paste. I can't read it because it's too much. Here we go. This is happening. You are going to go on and vote for me, Cameron.
Vote for Christina.
Taylor. Sly.
Thank you,
Sly. Taylor's got some sly plans for the competition.
I knew this was going to devolve to this sort of thing.
The web address is http://.
Oh, yeah, all of that.
juno-opera.org/who's-your-diva-2013/#Cameron.
Okay. And if you don't want to do all that, just Google Divas Juno and it'll come right up.
Juno Lyric Opera, yeah.
It works every time.
And then click on my face.
Yeah.
Taylor.
Or Christina's face.
Uh-huh. I have long brown hair with curls.
Uh-huh. Oh, thanks, Taylor.
Yep. Now you know it won't miss me.
Just to put a last word in before we close on this little chapter. I will mow your lawn if you vote for me. Need some leaves raked?
I'm a lot stronger than her.
Make sure you put a little note. She's taller. I'm stronger.
Longer legs, more room to cover.
I'm a black belt in Taekwondo.
When she was 12.
So therefore,
Whoa,
she took it a step further.
We're good friends.
But yeah, if you want to favor them, I would love to do a favor in exchange for a donation. Cameron.
It's out of control.
As, I'll let Pat
as
take
it
the
always
paper
is when the divas come down here. I never know exactly how this is going to come out. I always think you should just bring your accompanist and sing. Somebody tell us what's going to happen tomorrow night or at the divas show. What form does it take?
Well, this is Taylor. Each of us are going to sing, in case you can't tell by... Anyways, each of us are singing two songs. The first half of the show is an acoustic, like an acoustic set, I suppose.
Yeah, okay.
We're each doing one song with either a piano accompaniment or I think someone has a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe two people have guitar. And then there's going to be an intermission where
You
can get up and vote.
Cameron.
We're going to have boxes on the side that you can slip cash into, and I think there's going to be, like, credit card readers around. You'll know where to put your money.
Right.
They'll make sure of that. And then the second half, we will be joined by a band, and we each do one more song where you can vote again on whoever you think is doing the best diva job.
And you can vote all night long point. And just to reiterate, we're all competing up here in the studio, but it's for a great cause.
Yeah, and can we talk about that cause? Where does the money go?
It goes straight to Juno Lyric Opera, and they do an incredible job of giving local artists a plateau to perform on, a stage to exist on. They did Hairspray. It's not just opera. Hairspray was Juno Lyric Opera. They're putting on...
La Traviata is going to be at the end of September. I will be singing in the chorus for La Traviata. This is Christina. So I'll be up on stage again for that. And it's super important to support the arts in general and Juno Lyric Opera specifically because it keeps the community vibrant.
Yeah.
And it really... spices things up and enlivens where you live. And so it's super important to help keep these companies alive.
And they're efficient. I mean, Juno Lyric Opera, it's one part-time staff member, and the rest is volunteers. So you're just, all your money is going directly out there to getting things done. You know, it doesn't hang in limbo somewhere. It's a great system. They do an incredible job.
I've had a wonderful experience this summer. I took a job driving a tour bus. And I make these half-hour trips back and forth between downtown and Stater Harbor. And on the way, I get to talking to people. And invariably, the question that comes up on the bus is, what do you all do around here in the winter? And I start describing the art scene because I do this show and I'm kind of in touch with the overall art scene in Juneau. And when I start talking about what all we have here, the bus gets really quiet. And these are people from big cities. These are people from places outside where, you know, I mean, on a Saturday night, there's 150,000 things to do. And then I talk about the nature of our art scene being so participatory that if you have a spark of talent and you want to be on stage, it's very easy to find yourself, learning to be a great performer. And they can't believe the opportunities that we have here. When I start talking about them, they just go crazy back there in the back of the bus. So it's really wonderful. And you are living proof that wonderful art scene that we have here is alive and well and just doing a great job. Thank you for stepping forward. Thanks for getting up there on the stage and doing this thing. And I wish you all good luck, and I hope you all win. There's got to be some way that everybody can walk away from this thing as the diva in charge or whatever the winner of this whole thing is called. Thanks so much for coming down and talking to us. Good luck,
Pat.
Everybody.
Thank you.
And,
thank you, Pat.
Great,
for having
great
us.
Event.
Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 6th of September, 2013. It was on this day, 1620, that the Mayflower sailed from Plymouth, England, bound for the New World, carrying the people we know as pilgrims. They called themselves separatists or saints. They wanted to separate from the Church of England. They'd commissioned two boats for the journey, the Speedwell and the Mayflower. The Speedwell started to leak when they set out. They went back, they tried to repair it, and they lost some time. So they arrived in the New World in December, December 21st, 3 months after they left. Historians believe the Mayflower was about 90 feet long, carried 102 passengers and food and livestock, tools, stuff they needed to get through the winter. Passengers rode in a large open cargo area. But at least it smelled good because the ship had previously been used to transport wine. There were no sanitary facilities, little fresh water. Many of the passengers became seasick. They ate cheese and fish or salted beef, cold food. They intended to land near the mouth of the Hudson River, but they were off course, landed near Cape Cod, spent a month searching for a place to settle. Only half of the colonists and the crew survived that first winter. But today, about 35 million people are direct descendants of those Mayflower pilgrims. It was on this day, 1522, that one of the five ships that had set out with Magellan returned to Spain, having sailed around the globe. Magellan had been dead for more than a year. He got involved in a tribal conflict in the Philippines. The ship that made it to Spain on this day in 1522 was the Vitoria. It returned with just 18 of the original 237 men aboard. And it was on this day in 1847, Henry David Thoreau left Walden Pond, moved back to Concord to his father's house, having lived in the woods for 2 years. He brought with him the first draft of his book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, which he'd strung together from 10 years of journal entries. And it's the birthday of the writer Alice Sebold, born in Madison, Wisconsin, 1963. Her first novel, The Lovely Bones, was a New York Times bestseller for more than a year in 2002. Here's a poem for today by Jeffrey Harrison, Green Canoe. I don't often get the chance any longer to go out alone in the green canoe and lying in the bottom of the boat, just drift where the breeze takes me, down to the other end of the lake or into some cove without my knowing, because I can't see anything over the gunwales but sky as I lie there, feeling the ribs of the boat as my own, this floating pod with a body inside it. Also a mind that drifts among clouds and the sounds that carry over water. A flutter of birdsong, a screen door slamming shut, as well as the usual stuff that clutters it, but slowed down, opened up, like the fluff of milkweed tugged from its husk and floating over the lake, to be mistaken for mayflies at dusk by feeding trout, or be carried away to a place where the seeds might sprout. Jeffrey Harrison's poem Green Canoe from his collection Feeding the Fire, published by Sarah Band Books and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Isn't it nice to have Garrison Keillor back? Hey, it's 33 minutes after 3. That's like 27, 26 minutes before 4 is, I think, the same kind of thing there about, right? Hey, my next guests are here, and they're here to tell us about the play that is opening, did you say Friday?
Friday the 13th.
Wow. Yeah. It's getting to be fall, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We have Perone Yousafzada here. She's flown in fresh from New York to direct this play. And Art Roach, of course, is here. You heard his bass rumble over there just a second ago. And the play is, this time, it's a comedy. And it is called The God of Carnage. Off of the New York stage, played around the world. It's British to start with. Well, actually, French,
I think.
Yeah, French to start with, and then translated into English and rewritten on the stage, I guess, in England. and then after the first couple of performances to spiff up the English, and then
right. There's two English language versions of it, actually, which interesting.
Okay.
Yasmina
yeah.
Reza is the French playwright who wrote it, and it started based on a sort of a what if, in which she had a friend whose young son had a missing tooth, and as a result of a playground incident, and then Christopher Hampson, who's worked with Yasmina as a translator many times, adapted it for the British stage into British English, and then readapted it again into American English for the New York stage originally. It's been done around the country many times now.
Now, without giving away all of the pieces of the play, that we got a kind of a glimpse of the plot there, but Perman, can you give us a kind of a summary?
Sure. At the beginning of the play, we meet two couples, the Novaks and the Raleighs, who are convening at the Novaks' home to talk about a playground incident that occurred between their two sons. And what begins as a very civil and polite conversation devolves from there, and the topic at hand of who's at fault and how best to ameliorate the problem then goes into many other things, including aspects of the marriages between the two couples and their parenting tactics and much bigger and more existential questions as we go along.
You learn a lot about yourself being a parent, I suppose.
You do.
And nights like this or conversations like this would be one way it happens, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I learned a great deal about it myself when I became a parent, and it was not all good to learn. Children have a tendency to be able to find all of the things you don't like about yourself and play them back to you. They're like little recording instruments that all, that are very selective in nature. So anyway, so is this your first out with this particular play?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but you've directed other stuff.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can you give us a taste?
Of other projects
yeah,
that
whatever,
I've done?
Yeah.
I tend to do a lot of new plays, collaborating with playwrights in the rehearsal room, and other contemporary works like God of Carnage, and some of the other plays that I've done have been some classics as well. I've worked on some Shakespeare and Chekhov and a whole range of things. I like to keep myself on my toes and keep surprising myself and challenging myself to work on different things.
And you do most of this work out of New York? Or?
Yeah, most of it out of New York, although this year has a bit of travel involved after Alaska, which I'm also looking forward to. And it's nice to get out of New York from time to time and get to know different communities, which is a large part of why I'm enjoying myself here.
Now, the cast is, I believe, they're, well, is everybody local art that's in the
three
camp?
Of the four. So
three
there's
of the four, okay.
There's four actors, two couples, of course. Brandon Demery is playing Alan Raleigh, the lawyer, who's visiting. And his
cell
wife,
phone glued to his
cell phone,
okay.
And he's dealing with a pressing case that's, yeah, it's pretty, you know the type. And then his wife is played by Allison Holtkamp, who is, I think she does wealth management as a living, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she's, they're one kind of parent. Well, they're each their own kind of parent, but they're one kind of couple. And then the host and hostess, the host is played by James Sullivan, who he's playing Michael Novak, and then his wife is making her debut with us. Her name is Anya Windham, and we met her up in Anchorage, as we've been up in Anchorage regularly, and she's come in to play this, and she's got a wonderful sort of dryness to the character that's very fun.
And Sullivan is...
And James is playing Michael Novak.
Know,
he's local.
Yeah.
He's, yeah, he's...
Other roles?
They might be the... He's played... well, Allison and James were together in Oklahoma last winter. He was Will, and she was Ado Annie. James was in some... He's done some contemporary plays with us as well, like Circle Mirror Transformation and Animals Out of Paper. He's very good at them. So this is right in his wheelhouse. He's quite wonderful in this.
So here's my question. Mm-hmm. So you come in from New York, and you got this local cast around here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, How does the chemistry work? Did you have problems? I mean, did they accept you, or were they, who's this lady from New York?
I think that any rehearsal process is sort of akin to dating, and by the time you're in tech, you're living together, you know? It was definitely a new experience for me in that I first encountered the actors in video audition format, and so... the first rehearsal was the first time that I met them face to face. It was heartening because I learned that the videos do reflect who they are and what they're capable of, and I was, you know,
happy to see that my instincts were confirmed. And I think that other than that, though, it's really not unlike working with any actor for the first time, in that it takes some time to get to know them and see what makes them tick and what sort of directorial theatrical language they respond best to. And from there, we, you know, can further deepen our collaboration and just, you know, get to work. So I've just been delighted, and they've been wonderful.
Our little theater here is one of the most interesting spaces I think I've ever attended drama in. Mm-hmm. It's got more trapdoors than you would imagine, and they come at very surprising places in all of the productions around here. How did you find the facility when you were working in it?
The space?
Yeah.
I think it's great. It's challenging in certain ways, just in terms of the way the audience is configured, but I really like working in thrust spaces. I think that they can be really
thrust
dynamic.
Thrust spaces.
In that the audience, it's not a proscenium, so the audience is sort of around the stage as well as in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it has a lot of character, and it's nice to be in a space that has such a rich history.
Now, my favorite seats are the three in the front row.
Yeah, those are great.
But you have to keep your legs back.
Yeah, and you'll want to at this one.
Tripping and accurate. I know about that line that they can't cross, but I keep thinking, you know, in the moment, someone could wind up in my lap. So, Art, you did the set designs.
I did, yeah.
And the rest of the crew were, I think, all local folks.
The creative team, let's see, I did the set design. The costume design is by a designer
Metzger,
I met in
right?
Anchorage,
yeah.
Colleen
oh,
Metzger,
okay.
And that's been a great collaboration. She's a recent newcomer to the state, and she's teaching mm-hmm. costume design at UAA. She's terrific. And the sound is by Betsy Sims. So she's been engineering our sound for years, and this is one of her first designs on the main stage. And then Perrone's husband, Mike, came in to do the lighting.
Okay.
So
okay,
we have a guest lighting designer, which is terrific.
Yeah. So now you put this creative crew together, and there's this lady from New York who's going to direct the show.
Right.
So the question is, how'd that work?
Pretty easily. I knew Colleen from working with her before, so we had that experience. Mike is a graduate of the same training program I went through at NYU. And I found that whenever I work with graduates of that program, there's a lot of vocabulary about the process that we have because we have the same teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a terrific artist. I mean, they're all really good artists. And Betsy is one of the easiest people to work with in the world. I mean, she's super talented and just a great lady and did a really nice job. I remember talking about where to go with the sound design. And I said, well, here's the person who can go any direction you need. And it's not a deep, complicated show to do sound for,
mm-hmm.
which is one reason she took it on, you know, with all the other things she's doing. But she was able to give us whatever we needed. So it was, you know, it was pretty, I thought it was a smooth process.
Perrone, have you had a chance to wander around Juneau a little bit and kind of get a feel for us here?
Yeah, a little bit. I've checked out the glacier and gone on some hikes and checked out downtown and the State Museum a little bit. So, yeah, I've definitely been using some of my free time during the days to explore the city and see what it has to offer.
During the production, where are you physically going to be?
During the run of the show?
Yeah, during the run.
Well, I'll be here through opening, and then I head back to New York after that. And then from there, pretty soon after, head to Philadelphia to start rehearsals for my next project.
You're going to see a really interesting thing at opening.
What's
that? And that is a Juneau audience.
I'm excited.
It is. You have to understand that we have to make our own theater here.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the wonderful things about Juneau
mm-hmm.
is that we sing, we dance, and it's all of us. Half the town of Juneau, I think, plays a musical instrument or sings or is in plays or dances or something like that because we are isolated. We're not connected to the road system, the rest of the world. And it's pressured us all to bring our talent to the fore. So you're going to see an audience that is incredibly talented and very, very tightly involved in what you're doing down there. And it'll be an interesting experience for you from large city audiences,
yeah.
I'll bet you.
Yeah, I look forward
to it. Art can tell you a little about that
because
mm-hmm. it's a shock to, I think, most people who come in from outside at how totally involved we can be in a play. So you will be received warmly and richly, I'm sure.
Oh, cool.
When can people see this?
Well, we have a preview on Sunday night and another preview on Wednesday night coming up this week. Those are both pay as you will, so admission at the door, just show up. The curtain's at 7:30. And then the run starts on Friday, September 13th, runs for 4 weekends. Thursdays through Sunday, 7:30 curtains, with the exception of the last Sunday in October, which is October 6th. There's a 2 o'clock matinee. Tickets are at perseverancetheater.org, or by going to the Jack, or by going into the bookstores, Hearthside Books, in either locations.
Art, there's a season ticket special deal where you can
there
pick
is.
A certain number of plays or something like that.
Absolutely.
Could you briefly outline
that? Yeah, subscriptions are available. Those are easiest to get by calling 463-TIXS. And subscribers get a discount over single ticket prices. If you buy all five shows, you basically get one for free. It's a terrific lineup. And then there's also the option of picking three or picking four, and you get the same discount. It just doesn't add up to as much money, of course. And the other great benefit for subscribers is you not only save money, but if your plans change, we'll waive the change fee and just move you to another equally priced night at no cost. And that's something single ticket buyers don't get. So you get good seats by coming in early. You help us out, and then we'll waive that change fee for you.
Okay, run that schedule by us one more time, and then let's
Friday
go.
The 13th. Shows are Thursday through Sunday at 7:30, with the exception of October 6th, when we close with a 2 o'clock matinee.
Baron Yousafzadeh, Art Roach, thank you so much for coming down. Thanks for telling us about the play and Break a Leg.
Thanks,
thank
Pat.
You.
Support for this program comes from Balloons by Night Moods, providing Juneau with new, used, and consigned party goods. Balloons by Night Moods, located at 9342 Glacier Highway in the Valley. More info at 523-1099.
I'm Holly Cern, president of the Bartlett Regional Hospital Foundation, inviting you to our annual seafood gala Saturday, September 7th at 6 p.m. Enjoy an elegant evening atop Mount Roberts Tram, featuring a delicious seafood dinner prepared by celebrity chef Jesse Ziff Cool. All proceeds benefit sexual assault exam certification for Bartlett nurses. Thank you to Guardian Flight and ASME and others who made this possible. Get your tickets at the Jack and Hearthside Books today. This message brought to you by the Bartlett Regional Hospital Foundation.
It's just about 12 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for a Juneau Afternoon. And in the studio with me right now, I have Thaya Schaub and Mark Binsel, and they are putting out a call to artists for a new undertaking, or I guess it already exists, and that's the Juneau Artist Gallery, right?
That's right.
So what's up?
Well, we're looking for fresh artists out there in Juneau. Juneau has such a rich artist community. We're hoping a few people are listening that are thinking about maybe selling their work in a gallery and would like to become part of our cooperative. We have about how many, Mark?
21 artists.
21 artists currently.
Where is the Juneau Artist Gallery?
We're in the Senate Building at 175 South Franklin.
First floor?
Yes.
Yeah.
And well, we've been in that location since about 2003. We were in the same building, but upstairs prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an opportunity for local artists to feel that they're ready to become professional and sell their art to the public. We have a good traffic flow with both visitors and the locals in that location, and we look forward to welcoming new artists.
So unlike a lot of the places on Franklin Street, particularly south of the Red Dog Saloon, you're open year-round.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. We're open year-round, and there's always an artist on duty. because we're an artist co-op, we all own the shop together, and one of us is always there. And there used to be two. The business hasn't been quite as busy this summer, maybe because of the sun, but we always have an artist there. It's always one of us working the shop. And the thing that's nice about that is getting to interact with the customers, and it's amazing how gratifying it is when somebody looks at your work and compliments you, or even if they're not buying it, it feels great to have that communication with the customers. At least I really enjoy it. I think most of our artists really do like that aspect of it. And it's something that I think artists who may be listening might want to think about. That's how you kind of find out what sells, if you want to get out there and talk with the people that are looking at your stuff, that you can kind of see what they like and maybe what they don't like so much, and you get to keep more of your the price that is paid. You get to keep 85% of it when you're a artist at the co-op, whereas in a regular gallery, it could be 40 or 50% that they take. So
typically. That's what I was going to ask, was how does the cost structure work? Do you have to pay a fee to join the co-op?
There's a small joining fee of $250, and then we each pay a set fee based on the amount of space that we have, which is designed to pay the rent on the building. And then we each work a few of the hours required, but with 21 artists, the workload of running the gallery and working it and doing many of the little odd jobs is all spread out among all of us, so that's not too much of a burden. And then after that, whatever sales we get 85% back to us.
There's got to be a balance between how many people can be in the co-op and how much space you have available for have you worked out the optimum number? I know it would have to do with the size of the art, but...
Yeah, we feel that... right now we have 21 artists, and it really works very well at about 25. Mm-hmm. And that's with an artist, a longstanding artist, Patty Baumgartner, who's going to be leaving at the end of this summer. And also well-known artists, Tasha Whalen and Lincoln Farabee, have moved out of town. So this is creating some openings. But it really works at about 25, I think. That pretty much fills up the walls and the space while still leaving ample room for little space between artists at work, and then also, of course, for traffic flow in the gallery. Right. Anything more than that, we get a little bit too full.
It's a real popular spot for First Fridays. I know
it is.
Everyone seems to drop in there during the course of a First Friday art walk around here.
And although we've said this is an artist search and we're encouraging artists to come in, our First Friday is just like normal. Come in. It is really open for everybody, and we're looking forward to seeing people and having them come chat with us and enjoy some snacks and ask if you are interested as an artist to come see us. And of course, it's not just this week. Anytime you can call and get the information. But we're pretty proud of our spot and the artists that we have. We've lost it. In the last year, we've lost, due to moving, a couple of ceramic artists. And we're kind of low on that. That's one thing. But and we just lost Tasha and Lincoln. Did jewelry and glass, and you know we're looking at all kinds of different things. So, mm-hmm. If you think you're a talent that you might want to sell, put in an application. We do have a juring process.
How does that work?
We have a committee that is a membership committee. They would take the application. You fill out the application first. They take the application, and then they interview the artist and get an idea if their work schedule, if their what they anticipate, and answer questions to see if they're a good fit for the gallery. And if the membership committee thinks that they're a good fit, then they bring in their work for all of the artists to vote on, and so you basically are juried in by vote of the membership.
in many ways, that's a good thing. If you are accepted in that fashion, then you know that a group of people with some artistic judgment has judged your work and found you not wanting, I guess. So that's really a kind of a plus opportunity here.
Yes. I mean, in the time I've been in the gallery, there's been, you know, you feel bad when you reject someone, but it gives them a wake-up call and they understand and good feedback, frankly, good feedback about how they can improve their art.
Mm-hmm. I guess the question, you probably have right now more traffic than you'll have during the winter through the gallery, because even though South Franklin is kind of stopped off at the Red Dog, there is a little bit of bleed over and a lot of people do come up from the ships. The question is, during the winter season, if you're on display at the gallery, do you get adequate exposure?
Well, it certainly does slow down. Christmas is great, starting, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. January is a pretty slow month. February pops up because people do, you know,
Valentine's Day is an opportunity for gift-giving.
And we actually really do get a lot of people coming in buying going away gifts for, you know, from people from the state office building, the federal building. And a lot of the people from the legislature come down. We have some fans that come and see us every year. You know, one thing though that I'm glad you mentioned about the slowing down, it's a perfect time actually to join the gallery, because we do, when you join, it is a one-year commitment. And usually when someone chooses to leave, it's right after the tourist season, because that is our busiest season. So coming in about this in the fall is a good time. You can get up to speed with the, you know, what the gallery, how it works and everything, and get your feet wet, and then be ready for the busier seasons.
I think that the cross-networking of the friends and acquaintances and patrons of 21 artists all in one shop in a small town like Juneau sort of magnify the presence that we have. We also have the advantage of being in the Senate Building Mall with popular shops, Boheme, and also the Bear's Lair, and the Fly Shop brings in quite a few of my friends to the building.
So I guess the other, you keep mentioning the fact that there's this 21 artist cooperative. Do the 21 artists who are currently in there do other things in collaboration? Is that something that grows out of being in the same exhibit space?
Yes, because there's so many different tasks needed in running the gallery, like bookkeeping, design work, advertising, marketing, web page, these kind of things. Those kind of skills, it helps. If an artist has those, that those can sort of cut down on the amount of time they might need to work a shift in the gallery. Mm-hmm. or other things. But it all adds up to the contributions of the different members adds up to running the gallery, and then we have to outsource where we don't have the skills. But so other skills that an artist brings to the gallery are a great benefit and often can be utilized.
The art scene in Juneau is truly an amazing thing. We've talked about it a couple of times on this show. I had three of the divas in here just moments ago, and just before you came in, Art Roach and Perone Yousafzadeh from New York, who's directing the play that's opening up. They are in the first two pay-as-you-can performances are Wednesday and Friday night, or Friday and Sunday. Anyway, we have such a rich thing here. But the thing that that I've been reflecting on just recently is how totally participatory our art scene is here. If you have the slightest spark of talent, this is a very, very easy community to find yourself showing your stuff in a gallery on Franklin Street. So I wish you good luck in your call for artists. I hope that we get some response to this and see some new stuff up on the wall.
Okay, we'll be at the gallery here this afternoon.
Yeah,
for the first Friday.
Yeah.
It is. Okay. Thank you, Pat. It's nice to meet you. Finally,
yeah.
I heard your voice many times on the radio, but hadn't seen your face. So
well,
very nice to meet you.
It's a delight to meet you as well.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, Evening at Egan presents Geographies of the Land and of the Heart, readings in conversation with former Alaska writer laureate Peggy Shoemaker. At 9, four provocative investigative reports link the economic crisis in Europe and the American economy on Europe's debt, America's crisis. Great decisions in foreign policy, Platts Energy Week, This Week in Defense News, and BioCentury This Week round out the evening. Tonight on 360 North.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We are broadcasting on K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, we're on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're online at ktoo.org, and support for national programming to KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.